court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're here to hear 03-1813, Lawrence A. Kruckenberg versus Paul S. Harvey. Arguing for Mr. Kruckenberg is Attorney William H. Gergen. Mr. Gergen, you may proceed.
Chief Justice Abramson, Honored Justices, Mr. Wood, my name is William Gergen and I am appearing on behalf of Lawrence Kruckenberg in this matter. Where the Kruckenberg-Harvey lot line is might not matter to the development of Wisconsin law a whole lot, but how its location is to be determined is very, very important. Back in 1982, a ditch was dug by Mr. Kruckenberg's neighbor, Mr. Harvey, and a lawsuit was filed by Kruckenberg's predecessor entitled Mr. Suzuki. The lawsuit alleged a lack of lateral support, that the ditch was causing erosion. Neither side commissioned a survey to determine the exact location of the lot line at that time.
Also, can I just stop you there? Because as I read the complaint filed by the predecessor, your predecessor in interest, the ditch was dug and it interfered, the lateral erosion excavation interfered with the line fence.
Yes, sir.
Now, when you went through the facts, are you discounting the fact that this was a line fence?
Not at all, Your Honor. The line fence was alleged by Suzuki in his complaint in both paragraph 6 and paragraph 9. The reference to the line fence was considered by the trial judge to be very important in this case because it indicated that this was a fence that the parties believed to be the lot line at that time. Far from discounting it, I rather would point to the belief that I have in the law that with respect to an adverse possession claim, the beliefs of the parties are not particularly relevant. In other words, they don't operate to change the law of adverse possession one way or the other. And so the fact that the parties both believed that this fence constituted the line, while it may explain their subsequent inaction with respect to determining the line at that point in time, does not, in the final analysis, as we go along this afternoon, decide the case.
The reason I ask that is because when you look at the new survey, which is on the other side of the ditch, then the ditch actually was dug on your client's land and there would have been no argument in the first place. Is that incorrect?
Ditch is actually dug on what is Kruckenberg's land according to the deed line.
Yes. So in other words.
But it's Harvey's ditch. So
Harvey's trespassing. That's your argument.
Harvey's ditch. Harvey's the one who dug that ditch, and so therefore there would be an issue, and would have been back in 1982, had Suzuki realized that the ditch was dug on the "quote unquote" wrong side of the line.
Well, I guess I have a question about that because I was wondering also about paragraph 6 of the complaint. Said excavation has caused the line fence between plaintiff and defendant to collapse. So we know the line fence is somewhere, but do we know whether the line fence was on one end or the other of the excavation, or do we know where it was? Is there any way to tell from the 1982 record?
From the 1982 record, no. From the subsequent survey that has been provided and made a part of this record, the fence that is referred to in that complaint as a line fence, which I would maintain is not actually a line fence because it wasn't on the correct line, but nevertheless, was falling somewhat and the dirt around it was eroding into the ditch. The fence itself, or the remnants of it, extend beyond the ends of the ditch, so that the fence does extend laterally along the lot line, or at least more or less parallel to the lot line, further than does the ditch. The ditch kind of approaches the lot line, crosses it actually, and then comes back in a bit of a U shape.
Where is the ditch? On whose property is the ditch as of the survey?
Kruckenberg's property. Actually, both, like I say. It enters and comes back. It's a kind of a U.
All right. So as of 82, though, when the original suit was filed, both parties assumed the ditch was on Harvey's property.
That's certainly my belief and my reading of the record, Your Honor.
That's why it was a claim of erosion, not trespass.
That is my belief, Your Honor, yes.
And just so that I'm clear, that fence, the line fence back in 82, was restored, is that correct?
Not particularly, Your Honor. I believe that as of our filing of our suit in 2001, the fence was in pretty much the same dilapidated condition that it's been in. If one looks carefully,
it looked like the posts on both ends were up.
If one looks carefully at the attachment to the order of dismissal in this case, which includes the survey that takes a look at that fence, you'll see references such as found fence remnants, wood post, two strands of barbed wire grown into 7-inch maple, things like that.
Right.
It seems to me that it's a rather dilapidated fence that's been there a long time. That's the way I would read the record.
That's not the issue in the case, though.
No. Not in my opinion, Your Honor.
What's the issue in the case?
In my opinion, Your Honor, the issue in this case comes down to the proper application of claim preclusion and whether or not it's been properly applied in this case, whether the nature of a lot line is such that perhaps an exception needs to be made for lot lines, or that a more rigorous analysis must be done in a case such as this in order to properly apply claim preclusion analysis.
Was there a declaratory judgment in the first lawsuit?
No, ma'am. There was a stipulation, which was reduced to writing. There was an order of the trial court, neither of which mentioned, unfortunately, either the line fence or the lot line. The stipulation provided for a payment of $1,500 and for Mr. Harvey to plant some ryegrass, which he apparently did. The order dismissed with prejudice the lawsuit at that time for lateral support.
And the original lawsuit, did it ask for a declaratory judgment?
As to the location of the lot line? No, Chief.
Okay.
Not to my recollection.
Right. So you got a stipulation and order that says Harvey is liable for the erosion and has to do something about it.
He agreed to pay the $1,500 and plant the grass, yes.
Okay. Now, what's your second lawsuit about?
When we filed Mr. Kruckenberg's lawsuit in 2001, we asked for essentially three things. We filed on a trespass theory that Mr. Harvey was over the line cutting trees that he shouldn't have been cutting. We filed a lateral support cause of action, which indicated that in the last few years there had been additional erosion into the ditch. We are not pursuing that on this appeal, that particular claim that was dismissed by the trial court along with the others, it was upheld in the Court of Appeals, and we have not continued that argument to this court. But the third one, and probably the most important one, is we sought a declaratory judgment from the trial court as to the location of the lot line. Mr. Kruckenberg had a survey performed, and it had been determined by him that the line wasn't along that fence. It was rather along, more along a line of trees where Mr. Kruckenberg had previously indicated or saw that there were no trespassing signs, and that's what gave him the idea originally that maybe the ditch was over the line. And so he had the survey performed, and it confirmed his suspicions.
When were these trees cut, before or after the first lawsuit?
Oh, well after. It was shortly before we filed in 2001.
So that lawsuit could not have been brought in 81 or 82?
Not with respect to the trespass claim, not with respect to those trees. That's correct.
Okay. Now, the declaratory judgment as the lot line could have been brought in 81, 82.
That's correct. The declaratory judgment action, and this I think is important, could have been brought by either side at either time, theoretically, in my opinion. Any time you want to establish a lot line, it seems to me you could bring a declaratory judgment action in a circuit court to say, I have a need to declare this lot line because I want to do this, that, or the other thing. I want to know where to build my driveway. I want to know where to put my fence. I want to know where to build my ditch. And the problem, in my view, with the status of the case as it stands right now is that, in my opinion, while Mr. Suzuki had an opportunity, certainly, to ask for declaratory judgment as to the lot line or could have sued for trespass had he known where the lot line was at that time, at the same time, Mr. Harvey had a duty, and this is pursuant to the Vuza case that I cited to some criticism at the Court of Appeals level, in any event, had a duty to ascertain where his true lot line was and to remain on the correct side of it.
Counsel, can I ask, so if just looking at 82 and looking at today, regardless of how this lawsuit goes here, Mr. Harvey still would have a claim for adverse possession, wouldn't he? Having maintained there was a ditch there, there was a fence, and providing all of the requirements of adverse possession would be met, correct?
If he can meet the requirements of adverse possession, your decision here today would not obviate that in any way. We would be back to the trial court finding out substantively whether Mr. Harvey has a right to ownership of that land by virtue of that doctrine. There are a number of different results that could occur there. If the ditch is really the key to the adverse possession claim, then he may very well have an adverse possession claim as far as the ditch extends, but not necessarily laterally all the way along that fence line.
I was just thinking of adverse possession, openly, notoriously, adversely possessing. So, okay.
Well, the ditch probably qualifies, Your Honor, for that, which is why that whole 19-year thing as opposed to 20 years mattered to my client, which is why, quite honestly, we filed that lawsuit when we did. He understood that the clock was ticking, and I believe there's a case where it talks about the 11th-hour filing because somebody wakes up and realizes the lot line isn't where they think it is. It was an 11th-hour filing, but in my opinion, under this law, the clock doesn't strike midnight, and we don't turn into pumpkins until the 20th year. So I think that Mr. Kruckenberg, at least with respect to the ditch, still has a factual argument with respect to the adverse possession claim, but so is Mr. Harvey, depending on what he can prove. Now, we never got that far in discovery in this case because we had the summary judgment motion, the dismissal, and off we went to the Court of Appeals.
Could you summarize for me, putting aside adverse possession, what is it that Mr. Harvey is arguing caused the lot line to change so that he gained property and Mr. Kruckenberg, in effect, and his predecessor lost property? What is the legal event that caused the change in the lot line? And then what is your answer to that?
That's an excellent question, Justice Prosser. And I have to go to Judge McMonagle's decision in court at the summary judgment motion hearing. Judge McMonagle dismissed on claim preclusion grounds our lawsuit to determine where the lot line was. Logically, to me, that would preclude anybody from getting a determination as to where the lot line was, including Mr. Harvey, because he had the same opportunity back in 82 to ascertain where the lot line was as my client did, could have brought a suit at that time or any intervening time. So the really surprising thing to me about the court's next step was that he went ahead and located the lot line as being the fence line or the line fence. And he did that, it's my understanding, based upon the finding or the allegations in the complaint, paragraphs 6 and 9, that this was a line fence. Now, what Mr. Harvey's argument is to support that, I'm honestly somewhat unclear as to what that is, because quite frankly, with all due respect to the trial court, that finding seemed to fall right into his lap without a whole lot of argument. The lot line was located, and that's what we were at that point sort of stuck with. It seems to me to be inconsistent, and my response to it is on a number of levels. First of all, Mr. Harvey had ignored any duty he had to locate his lot line and stay behind it by digging the ditch over the lot line in the first place. Mr. Suzuki failed to locate the lot line or bring a declaratory judgment action back in 1982, and if that precludes my client from bringing it now, the problem is when the court then moves the lot line to the fence line or line fence, Mr. Harvey has now been rewarded for ignoring his duty to stay on his side of the line and ignoring any obligation he might have to bring a declaratory judgment as to the location of the lot line. He's been rewarded, while my client, Mr. Kruckenberg, has been penalized and has lost land in a situation where he's not being allowed to even ask a court to determine where the lot line is. It's just all been sort of predetermined. Now, the greater problem with that from a policy standpoint is that in the intervening 19 years, there's not a title company in Wisconsin that would have looked at that judgment of dismissal and seen that the lot line moved. There was no mention of the lot line in the judgment of dismissal, order of dismissal. There was no mention of the lot line in the stipulation. And so my response to that argument that that lot line can be moved is to simply question how did that happen. I still, as I stand here today, don't understand the legal theory on which the learned trial judge made that finding.
Who put up the fence and when?
No idea, Your Honor. This is a fence. If I could say that it was in the mists of antiquity, I don't think I would be far off, as antiquity is measured in our young country. That fence seems to go back a number of years. There is something in Mr. Kruckenberg's affidavit with respect to summary judgment that indicates that he had an aerial photograph that he believed showed that the fence line was there way back in, I believe it was the 30s, I'd have to check, but a good long time before Kruckenberg and Harvey came on the scene, Your Honor.
But the fence was described in the complaint as a line fence. Are those words, do they mean something legally, a legal line fence?
I don't disagree with the trial court's finding that those words have meaning. Line fence is, in parlance, as I understand it, a fence that's along a lot line. I don't disagree with that finding. I just strongly disagree with the import and the weight that the judge gave that allegation, particularly in view of the fact that the defendant Harvey in the initial case denied those allegations in his answer. That seems another thing that he wouldn't be ordinarily entitled to the benefit of getting a finding on something fortuitously that he denied.
It seems... Okay, let's go back. Claim preclusion ordinarily means any issue adjudicated or that could have been adjudicated. That's the ordinary meaning, right?
That's the part we're tripping over, is the could have been adjudicated part.
And what you're saying here is you think that this case should fall into an exception to that general rule. Like
it's difficult for me to tell this court, from my perspective, how the law should be fashioned or made. I certainly feel comfortable, however, making suggestions. The nature of the lot line is such that it does not seem to fit the transactional analysis real well. We don't have a car crash that leads to injuries. We don't have a firing that leads to a wrongful termination suit. We have a lot line that is established presumably when someone gives a deed, and that had nothing to do with the digging of a ditch. So the location of the lot line by its very nature is semi-permanent. It could be moved. It could be moved by a court saying there was an adverse possession. It could be moved by a deed subsequently that redraws the lines. But short of those types of things, the lot line is geometrically determinable. A survey can tell you where it is physically on the land. And therefore, to say that it fits the transactional analysis that is ordinarily applied in a strict claim preclusion case, to me, is a stretch. If you look at the requisites and the things that are to be taken into account, you know, are those facts, the digging of the ditch and the lot line related as to time. Well, the lot line is potentially almost timeless as opposed to the digging of the ditch, which is very definitive.
Counselor, I want to interrupt you a minute because there's something that's troubling me. If you have a claim for adverse possession of a particular piece of property, one of the issues in that lawsuit will be the location of the lot line, correct?
Well, the record location of the lot line, the location as of the title, and that's not disputed in this case.
If you have a claim for slander of title, where someone has incorporated part of your property into their property, one of the issues in the case is going to be the location of the true lot line, correct? And if you
potentially, I'm not sure about that, but I think I understand.
If you have a case for trespass, one of the things you're going to have to show is where the lot line is so you can show the other guy was on your property, correct?
Theoretically, but I will take issue with that statement because that is the same reasoning, I think, that the trial court used.
But, Counselor, in each of the claims I've told you about, those claims have separate and distinct elements. They are all different claims. What they have in common is a similar issue, the location of the lot line,
yes,
the legal location. Okay, so why are we here talking about claim preclusion? Why aren't we talking about issue preclusion in this case?
Well,
the issue being the true location of the lot line.
Justice Robinsack, as you know, I did argue that in my brief as well, that issue preclusion would seem to be something that might be applied to this case. In reading the cases on claim and issue preclusion, and I don't say this to be cynical at all, it seems to me that there's been confusion between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court on occasion. The Supreme Court telling the Court of Appeals, no, this isn't a claim preclusion case, this is an issue preclusion case. And it would not shock me if this Court came to that same conclusion in this case, because, as you indicated, Justice Robinsack, the location of the lot line can be an issue in any number of these types of cases.
Right.
The only time it becomes a claim is if somebody actually affirmatively makes it a claim. They ask the court to declare a judgment. And so it seems to me that that is the distinction upon which the trial court, which they did not appreciate in the way that they should have.
What are the elements of issue preclusion? Do you need the same parties?
We do not need the same parties.
Okay.
We need the issue to have been, the key element, and I'm sorry, the key element is that it needs to have been actually litigated previously. And in this case, I think it's very fair to say that this was not actually litigated. There were a couple of references in the original complaint in 1982, and then that all got, they didn't worry about it because they settled it on another basis.
But if the difference is whether it's actually litigated, and in claim preclusion it doesn't have to be actually litigated, if we move into issue preclusion, it would take over all of claim preclusion. Nothing would be left. Because in claim preclusion, really, the most of the time the issue is, was it, could it have been litigated? If it was actually litigated, those cases don't come up generally.
Right. I think the DePratt case is the good bedrock case to look at, or the classic case, in terms of why this rule exists in the first place. You've got a case of essentially suing twice for the same thing. And, you know, that's another reason why we did not pursue on this appeal that lateral support claim, because, quite frankly, my client and I decided with the Court of Appeals that looked like we were suing twice for the same thing. But that's not what we're doing in the case of trying to locate a lot line that needs to be located in order for people to have some idea as to how to behave going forward with respect to their property.
Counsel, this is the problem that I see in follow-up to the Chief's question. And you make reference to, well, you look at the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, they say issue, we say claim, or vice versa. And it's because I think that our analysis, depending on which one we choose, will make a difference as to what the decision is in this case, vis-a-vis whether or not it's been fully litigated. But you can do a flip of a coin as to which analysis is a viable analysis to begin with. As you say on page 12 of your brief, you say at where the lot line was in the 1982 case, at most was just an issue, just like Justice Rogensack says. So, sounds like should be an issue preclusion analysis. Easy case then. But then you go on to say, but of course in our claim preclusion analysis, and we here, in this case, this current case, we have a declaratory judgment. And the claim preclusion jurisprudence says an issue that was, you know, tried or could have been tried. And certainly declaratory judgment could have been tried in 1982. So the problem is you have both here. You have something that is, I think, an issue in the 1982 case. But under our jurisprudence of claim preclusion, it is a claim that could have been tried. And so which way do you want to go? Should we treat this as an issue, or should we treat this as a claim? And it can be treated as both. So which one should we choose?
Justice, I have the red light in front of me. I presume I'm allowed to answer this question?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. In the final analysis, with respect to lot lines, given the fact that either of the adjoining landowners could at any time bring a declaratory judgment action with respect to their lot line, it seems to me superfluous to do a claims preclusion analysis because it is meaningless as applied to one against the other. If one is precluded from determining the location of the lot line, so is the other one. And so you can't have the result in this case where the judge, in 2003 actually, by the time we moved the lot line 20 years later. That we can't have that. That doesn't make any common sense. What does make sense is that the lot line be viewed as an issue, but when you need to know what it is, a declaratory action should be permitted so that a judge can make a finding with respect to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gergen. Mr. Wood, representing Paul S. Harvey. Attorney Wood.
May it please the Court. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Glenn Wood. I represent the defendant respondent in this matter, Paul Harvey. The great American poet Robert Frost once wrote that good fences make good neighbors. He didn't comment, however, on the ramifications of a good fence in the wrong place. And I believe that that situation is at the core of the issues before the Court today. As I read the briefs and read the Court of Appeals decision, it appeared to me that there were two different primary issues in this case. The first is whether the factors for claim preclusion have been satisfied here, and more specifically, the second factor in identity of claims. And the second issue being whether a court, a lower court, is to apply a fundamental fairness test in claim preclusion cases. And I'm not sure what to make of the non-discussion on that so far today, but that was an issue before the Court of Appeals, and I believe it's ripe for determination by this court.
Let me ask, Mr. Wood, where do you see the identity of claims?
I see the identity of claims in the transactional analysis that has been adopted by this court. And if you look at the Northern States versus Buer case, which essentially adopted that transactional analysis, it stressed that a transactional analysis is rooted in fact. What matters is what the facts are. And specifically, the court in that case said, the number of theories that may be available is immaterial. If they all arise from the same factual underpinnings, they must all be brought in the same action or be barred. And here we have the same factual underpinnings. The fence line has not moved. The survey line or the true lot line has not moved. The location of the ditch has not moved. Essentially, we have the same facts that we had in 1982 at the time of that lawsuit. The difference is the knowledge of the parties at this point, based upon the 2000 or 2001 survey by Mr. Kruckenberg, has revealed that what was regarded as the line fence is not, in fact, the survey line. And as the Chief Justice has pointed out, in this analysis, we look at not only what was litigated, but what could have been litigated. And certainly, the plaintiff in the 1982 action could have obtained a survey, could have determined that there was a difference between the survey line and the fence line, and sued for trespass at that point for the ditch, could have sued for a declaratory judgment at that point.
Was the line fence, was the lot line in issue in 1982?
It was, to the extent that the plaintiff alleged on two different occasions in the complaint that the line fence was being damaged or was otherwise being implicated.
That talks about the damage to the fence. How was the line in issue in that case?
Well, I guess my understanding of line fence is that it has implications beyond a simple fence, and that it, as noted by the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court, is a legal term of art which has significance, which indicates when the terminology is used that this fence is the demarcation between neighboring landowners. It represents the line. And so to that extent, again, it was raised by the plaintiff, Mr. Kruckenberg's predecessor in title. I think it definitely was an issue in the 1982 case. I think
maybe I don't mean to nitpick, but as I understood it, that issue was the condition of the fence.
Correct.
How was the line in issue in 82?
It was alleged, again, as a line fence, and as noted by the Court of Appeals, that would have involved, if this case would have gone to trial, it would have involved having to prove the line. I mean, inherent in a line fence is the fact that it represents a line. And so it was an issue back then. It was the line. The
Mr. Harvey denied the line fence is referred to in paragraph 6 and 9 of the complaint. And Mr. Harvey denied both of those paragraphs.
Right, and I guess I was certainly not the attorney back then. I think I was about in fourth grade. But my understanding of the reason for the denial was not so much with regard to the line fence, but the allegation that the line fence was being damaged as a result of the excavation. I would note
that, close to my question, that was what was an issue back in 82.
It was perhaps the primary issue, but when you look at a claim preclusion and the transactional analysis, certainly that was an issue that was ripe for determination then. And with regard to the complaint, I would note that Mr. Harvey did admit paragraph 3, which states the defendant has caused an excavation to be made along the northern boundary of his property. The terminology northern boundary, I believe, is important here because that, well, it suggests anyway that Mr. Harvey acknowledged that this was the line fence. His denials, I guess, of the other paragraphs notwithstanding.
But just because he says it or your client denies it doesn't make it true, right? These are just pleadings.
Right.
Who was left to the trier of that?
I guess at this point, the Mr. Harvey's answer, I would argue, is not as important as Mr. Suzuki's allegation. And I believe that the plaintiff in the current lawsuit should be held to the previous allegation and what was, I believe, the understanding of the parties at the time. I can say that there, obviously, in the countryside, there are fences all over that are regarded as line fences. New survey technology would probably reveal that they may not be in the right place, but nevertheless, they have some significance. And the point I would stress is Mr. Suzuki, at the time of the 1982 lawsuit, could have obtained a survey and could have sued for not only trespass but declaratory judgment.
Counselor, you know, I asked opposing counsel a question that I prefaced with three different claims for relief that contain different elements to be proved. In each one of those claims, the legal lot line is something that would have to be found as a fact during the course of the trial. And I asked it because, frankly, this case to me seems like a recurring issue might be present. In other words, where's this lot line? Until we get to the declaratory judgment action, which has only that issue as its focus. And I guess I ask you the same question. Why aren't you you defending that this case shouldn't go forward based on issue preclusion? Or better, well, I know why you're going to say that, because it wasn't actually litigated. I guess you should tell me why I shouldn't decide it that way, because it seems it's a recurring issue to me.
I agree that the issue, it does seem like a recurring issue. Certainly the reason that I did not, at the trial court level, stress issue preclusion is because of what you noted. There was no litigation or no evidence of any litigation of the point back then. Claim preclusion analysis obviously deals with a different issue and perhaps has a broader scope in what it covers with regard to, again, a fact-based analysis under the transactional approach, but it requires a identity of the parties. And here we have that obviously present, an identity of the parties. So I believed and do believe that the three factors for claim preclusion have been met, with the understanding that the traditional approach to the second factor, identity of claims, has been.
But why isn't the claim for declaratory judgment different from the statutory claim of failing to provide lateral support? You have to prove different things when you're trying to prove that someone has not provided lateral support, correct?
Correct. The as I understand it, the legal relief that is being sought is different. The underlying facts, what's taken place on the property, has not changed. The facts are the same. It's the party's understanding of the facts that has changed. And therefore, there's a new form of relief that's being sought.
So you would have us interpret the transactional analysis to make this a compulsory claim to be joined with those made before rather than discretionary at the choice of the pleader, correct?
Essentially, yes, because...
Then why, if I'm going to do that, then how come we shouldn't bar your claim for adverse possession?
I believe, and I think it was argued or mentioned by the Court of Appeals, that in essence it was barred. The court didn't perhaps specifically address it, but under the approach that was taken here to preclude his claim for a declaratory judgment, I think my client's claim for adverse possession is likewise precluded.
But the court gives you the property then without an adjudication of the claim, because that's the result of the Court of Appeals decision is your client gets the property, right?
Essentially, yes. Okay. The original court order, I believe it's a part of the record, that I had proposed, a proposed court order, I should clarify that, was more specific regarding making a finding that the fence line is, in fact, the legal lot line. The court on the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration addressed that in some detail, as you can tell from the transcripts. And I was encouraged to modify the order, and now it simply says that the plaintiff's complaint, the causes of action in there, are precluded by the 1982 lawsuit, and the court makes a finding that the fence line referred to in that complaint is as follows, and then we attach the
and
survey.
How does, well, you still get the property. How does this, if I buy your argument and I apply a very broad definition of the transactional analysis looking at the facts, what do we do with the trees that weren't there before? How do I fit that in that transactional analysis?
As far as the conversion claim, the tree,
no.
The trees being, well, the property that the from which the trees were harvested were on the property belonging to Mr. Harvey because of the 1982 action. The court,
you're saying back in 1982 he gets this property, but there was no decision back in 1982.
There was no specific decision, but I guess the court is looking at a claim preclusion analysis now, and applying this analysis states that the facts were right for determination then. They were not, so any claim at this point, contrary to what was done back then or what could have been done back then, is precluded.
But if I buy your argument, don't I really shut down settlements? I mean, who is going to want to settle a lawsuit when it's going to have far-reaching impact as to ownership of property rather than just, did you provide support for this, lateral support for this ditch?
Well, I think that argument would work both ways, that taking a more narrow view of claim preclusion could have an adverse effect on settlements. From a hypothetical standpoint, I would argue that Mr. Harvey would have probably been a lot less likely to pay $1,500 to settle his suit in 1982, in which a line fence was alleged in the complaint, if he knew almost 20 years down the line he would be dealing with essentially the same set of facts. And without the and claim preclusion is rooted in the idea that there needs to be finality and judicial economy, and to avoid the vexation of repetitive lawsuits.
Right, I understand that there in this lawsuit there was a claim that he never did plant the grass that was part of the settlement from the past lawsuit, and I understand by opposing counsel's concessions here today that is not before us. I just have trouble seeing the parameters of how broad a factual setting you want us to use for a transactional analysis.
I don't think I'm asking the court to expand in any way its traditional, at least what I understand to be its traditional approach, which, as stated in Northern States Power versus Buehler, is this transactional analysis where you look at the factual underpinnings. There's language in NSP about how the transactional analysis is to be rooted in fact and looking at the facts.
But what if we said there was a mutual mistake? Both parties, I think it's clear after what Justice Robinson was stating, both parties thought that this was the line, the division between your client's property and opposing counsel's client's property. But they were both mistaken. In reality, the survey determined that's why you're here, that's why they're here, because of the survey. They wouldn't be here if there wasn't a survey. So
right.
Both of them, from what I can gather, thought that fence, one because he was there because the fence was falling in the ditch and he said he were digging it too close to the fence line. So that's, but both thought at that time. I don't think there's any question about that.
There is no question about that. As far as the mistake goes, I would note that under, I believe it's 8060, Section 80607, a party has the right within 1 year to address or reopen a lawsuit based upon mistake, and certainly the plaintiff in the current action owned the property within that 1 year time period. So I guess what we're looking at is how far to expand this transactional analysis, we get into what's fair. And if we're going to look at what's fair, I would argue that certainly it would have been, or the plaintiff in this lawsuit had the opportunity to address this issue back then and simply didn't. And I think that factors into any type of a fairness equation that we're going to, that this court would look at regarding the application of the transactional analysis as it relates to an identity of claims.
Counsel, perhaps I misunderstand your argument, because you just said the court will look at what's fair. Yet I understood your brief to suggest that there are, what, three elements of claim preclusion, and that the fundamental fairness is not part of the equation for claim preclusion. That's what I understood the argument in your brief to be.
That is correct.
And with regard to that, you would take issue then, no pun intended, I'm sorry, you would be at odds with the Court of Appeals in this case. The Court of Appeals, paragraph 20 and elsewhere in the opinion, indicated that even when the threshold requirements for claim preclusion are satisfied, we still must determine whether the application of the doctrine is fair. So you disagree with them.
I do, and that's why at the beginning of my argument I noted that this was one of the issues, as I understood it. It hadn't been addressed, but I think it needs to be addressed, because in doing the research for the briefs and then for oral argument, I came across several different Court of Appeals decisions which did apply a fundamental fairness test to claim preclusion, and I could find no decision of this court applying such a fairness test. Indeed, the cases of this court, starting with Northern States, distinguish between claim and issue preclusion by saying issue preclusion is a more narrow doctrine which requires the courts to apply a fundamental fairness test. And my understanding of that is because it doesn't have the same requirements, to wit, the identity of the parties. So certainly a non-party being bound to another lawsuit does have fairness implications, much more so than when you have an identity of the parties. And as recently as last year in the town of Delafield versus Winkleman, this court maintained that distinction that issue preclusion involves a fundamental fairness test, claim preclusion involves three factors that must be proven. And in fact, in that case, this court denied issue preclusion on fundamental fairness grounds, looking at the five factors set forth in the Michelle T. versus Crozier case, and denied claim preclusion on the grounds that I believe it was the identity of claims had not been satisfied.
So there are many, let me exaggerate a little because I only can think of two or three. There are many Court of Appeals cases, however, that indicate that fundamental fairness is the fourth element of the claims preclusion equation, right?
That's correct.
And so we would have to, overrule those cases or withdraw those cases? Is that what you're suggesting, withdraw the language of those cases?
I think that, and I don't obviously have a breakdown, but in a lot of those cases, claim preclusion was found in spite of any fundamental fairness test. But I think what is important for this court to do is to clarify that distinction between claim and issue preclusion. And as I understand the decisions of this court, they've always maintained a distinction, and issue preclusion has never been applied. The only exception since NSP versus Buehr that I can find involved the Safa v. Owens Corning case, and that, I don't think the word or the term fundamental fairness was ever mentioned in that decision as it related to claim preclusion. Rather, the court looked at policy issues there and went to, I think, into great detail to stress that a narrow exception to claim preclusion was being carved. And one of the bases for creating the exception was that the parties in that case, it involved asbestos litigation, the parties in that case could reasonably expect that malignant tumors would develop down the line, and that had the plaintiffs in the having a Hobson's choice between suing for the immediate effects and risking claim preclusion on malignant injuries should they occur versus holding off on the immediate effects, suing for malignant tumors if they occur, but running the risk that the statute of limitations now would then prohibit the immediate effects from being addressed. And the court said, in this situation, one can reasonably expect that malignant tumors would occur, and the repose interest of the defendant is not as substantial as it is in other claim preclusion cases. And here, I would argue that Mr. Harvey in 1982 could not have reasonably expected that almost 20 years later he would be dealing with another lawsuit which involved ramifications of the line fence, especially since the current plaintiff purchased the property shortly after the settlement of that case was reached.
It seems to me that applying a public policy exception might be this. Might not be, but it might be. And that is that if we should hold, as you ask, in every case involving real estate, and I may be exaggerating, but I don't think so, in every case involving real estate, to be safe, the plaintiff or the defendant would have to establish the boundary lines. Otherwise, if another case arose involving that real estate, the issue of the boundary lines would be precluded. So, take slander of title, take nuisance, take trespass, suit on a warranty deed. I mean, I can think of a lot of others, I suppose. You'd have to litigate the boundary lines. Otherwise, you're forever barred. Both sides, forever barred. Doesn't seem to make sense to me.
I think the way I respond to that is that the parties certainly have the opportunity at any time they bring a lawsuit regarding real estate, especially when you're in close proximity to a lot line or at least
you're always close proximity to a lot line by definition.
Well, most likely, unless it was an easement case or something like that, which was not along a
still line. Close proximity to the lines of the easement.
But certainly the parties in that suit, either side, has the opportunity to obtain a survey and to, I think it's better, it's an issue that's better addressed at the time.
Your answer to my question is that's right. Parties can do it. Might cost them hundreds of dollars to get a survey, but they better do it, even if it's not really an issue in the case.
Isn't the difficulty, and I'm responding to the Chief's proposal because I think it has some merit. The difficulty in that is that we're talking about a survey, but if you have a lot line or a fence line, there was an assumption that that was the line. So they could have put in the stipulation that the existing fence is the division line between property A and property B. That would have sufficed, correct? In other words, if they would have said that, there wouldn't have been, you wouldn't be here today.
Right, it would have been more helpful.
So the difficulty here is the lack of that. And I think the Chief is suggesting is that because that's not here, that can be an exception. In other words, there has to be a determination that that was not done, even though it could have been done. And there is an assumption that they thought that that was a lot line, it wasn't done. So whether it's an existing fence line or it's a survey, because an existing fence can be determined by adverse possession. In other words, if that's been the line for 30 years and we all thought it was a line and I've notoriously and openly defended that line, that would be the line, regardless of what a survey would say, because a survey is not the last word. So this, what I'm asking, with that exception, I know it isn't in your best interest, but you could have such an exception. In some way, you have to determine what the lot line is.
Yes, and I suppose you could have any number of exceptions, and certainly in another type of a lawsuit, we may have similar issues where it's looking at it now. And I think what we're getting at here is fairness, that it's unfair for Mr. Kruckenberg to be bound by Mr. Suzuki's omissions, if you will. And I guess I would respond in two ways to that. One is, if you, in looking at the SAFA case, it stressed that it was carving out a narrow exception, and there all exceptions should only be created for overriding policy reasons, and I'm not certain that this is the best case to establish overriding policy reasons. But as far as the fairness goes, Mr. Kruckenberg being bound by his predecessor in title's omissions, I think the law recognizes that type of unfairness in different areas of the law. For instance, in adverse possession, he is bound by the omissions of his predecessor or predecessors in title with the doctrine of tacking. In any claim preclusion case, if you're not dealing with the exact same parties, there's always an argument that it's unfair for a later party to be bound by the strategy and the tactics that the previous plaintiff chose. But if that, I think what you're getting at then is a fundamental fairness test, and the court has never done that and has always distinguished why it has done it in issue preclusion and not claim preclusion. And when we look at that fairness picture, I would point out that the plaintiff in this lawsuit bought the property at the time that this case was settling. He waited almost 20 years to order this survey. He could have, like I said, within 1 year, he could have undone this judgment, presumably, on the grounds of mistake. And I just don't see, if we're going to look at the fairness, you have to look at the fairness on both sides, I think, and this is not the case for creating such an exception.
Mr. Wood, if I could, I do not profess to be an expert in this area, so I need help. And my question is a very basic one that I'm having trouble following. But to have claim preclusion, as I understand it, you have it if both suits arise from the same transaction, same incident, or same factual situation. I'm having trouble seeing the sameness between what occurred in 1982 and the lawsuit that is currently being brought. Can you help me there?
Yes, the factual situation is the same. I mean, what are the issues here and what were the issues then? The line fence was an issue then. I mean, it was alleged in two different occasions.
Excavation was an issue in 1982.
But the line fence was as well. Not only the deterioration of the line fence, as you noted before, but the actual line being there. And when you look at the and factual underpinnings, I think, is what we're looking at with this transactional approach, the survey line hasn't changed either. The knowledge of the parties has changed as to where
the line hasn't changed. But what I'm getting at is, as I understand it, the factual situation, the incident, or the same transaction. There's got to be an identity there between transaction, situation, or facts. And the only thing that I hear you arguing is the same is the line.
I guess I would counter that with what's different other than the form of relief is different and the knowledge of the parties is different. But in the case
law, you've got a difference here. You've got cutting down trees versus excavating the area, correct?
But the underlying issue is the declaratory judgment. They're asking for declaratory judgment.
And there wasn't a declaratory judgment in 1982.
No, it was not. No.
So that's what I'm trying to get at. Help me with the sameness. That's what's missing here for me.
I don't know what other facts are involved other than the location of the fence and the location of the true survey line. It seems to me those are the two main facts. What are the differences between the two suits? The only differences that I see are the knowledge of the parties and the form of relief that they're seeking. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask, when did Mr. Krukenberg acquire the property?
It was in, Mr. Gergen's probably better equipped to handle that, but I believe it was in April or May of 1982, approximately the same time that the lawsuit in the 1982 action was settling.
Has Mr. Krukenberg paid taxes on the 16-foot strip since 1982?
Presumably his tax bill taxes him for the property that is set forth on his deed, so yes.
Was there any change in the taxes after Judge McGonigal's opinion?
I do not know that. Thank you.
Was the McGonigal's order or judgment recorded?
It was recorded, Your Honor, yes.
So people are on notice that the description of the land is not the equivalent to ownership.
Yes, I attached the survey that you have from MSA, and that show it depicts and describes the fence line.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gergen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Surprisingly enough, I find that I have so much to say and very little time in which to say it, which I appreciate your questions and the opportunity to answer them. I'll take a shot unless and until I'm interrupted. I had a really nice conclusion all drafted up, but I find it rather superfluous compared to what I want to say. I did note that the Beasley versus Conzo case, page 241, is the one where specifically the court talks about parties' beliefs being irrelevant when they're talking about, well, we thought the lot line was here, but it turns out it's over here, and now we've got an adverse possession claim. The beliefs are irrelevant, and I think they should be irrelevant in this case. They should not be given the weight that the trial court certainly gave it. With respect to Northern States Power, I want to say just a few things. At page 549, the court notes that as to both issue and claim preclusion, two factors that are important, two policy factors, are judicial efficiency and fairness to the victor. I think that's interesting language here, especially in view of the fact that there was a stipulation back in 1982. There was no victor. Nothing was tried. And so there was really no unfairness resulting to Harvey by allowing there to be a determination of the lot line at this point pursuant to the declaratory judgment action. In fact, as I indicated previously, I think Harvey's actually being rewarded for violating various duties back in 1982 and crossing the line by the court in 2003 going and moving the lot line. Is this, we want to have claim preclusion according to Northern States Power because the policies behind it are preventing repetitious and needless litigation, particularly needlessness. There was such a need to locate the lot line in this case that the judge did it even while he was dismissing the claim that asked him to do it. I would say that this litigation is anything but needless in that context. With respect to the SOFA case that was mentioned, that case does point out that the exceptions to claim preclusion are central and necessary for the fair administration of the doctrine itself, and that the doctrine should be utilized to render justice, not to deny it. Is this litigation necessary? Again, I would say yes, it is, and therefore this court will find, I hope, that it should have been allowed to go on. Now, the question is how to do that. I think that's been a really interesting discussion today so far in that is it claim, is it issue? It looks like an issue, but then, Mr. Gergen, you go and file a claim and mess that all up. But how else do we get the lot line determined is essentially where I'm at on that at this point. And I think the court has a number of choices. I honestly believe that the court could go back into Northern States Power, apply those doctrines very rigorously, and ultimately come to the conclusion that the transactional analysis, that the lot line just doesn't fit that. It's not part of this ditch-digging transaction that occurred in 1982. It surrounds it, it maybe infiltrates it, but it exists wholly independent of it. Yes, Mr. Kruckenberg could have brought his declaratory action, so could Mr. Harvey. So really, that's a sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander kind of thing. Either both need to be precluded, and therefore the judge can't move the lot line in 2001, or neither is precluded, and therefore we go ahead, we have our declaratory action suit, they go ahead and have their counterclaim with respect to adverse possession, and we find out substantively who has the right to occupy what piece of land here. The court could go a little further than that, however, and start looking at an exception for lot lines, and there's some justification for that as well. A number of possible cases had arisen, and I really didn't hardly have to leave my personal experience to take a look at some of them. My dog's in your yard. Your cat's in my yard. My kid's football's in your flower bed. The neighbor's coming into the other house uninvited. The kid's drum set is too loud. There's a noise issue. How far must he be from my property before he can play his drum set that loud? Well, where's the lot line? In all of those types of cases, the trees are overhanging my boathouse. Get them off there. Well, how far do I have to cut them back? Well, where's the lot line? In all of those cases, the lot line is potentially and theoretically an issue. If those cases are resolved without finding out where the lot line is, are we forever precluded as between those two pieces of property from finding out where the lot line is? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So possibly an exception for lot lines is appropriate. Possibly this court would simply want to do that transactional analysis, stick with the law as it is, and decide that it just doesn't meet those criteria. Or possibly, as has been suggested today, this really is an issue in the guise of a claim when you go to ask to locate the lot line, and there may be some distinction drawn on that basis. Any way you look at it, it seems to me that the result here is counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense, and this court needs to do something about it. Thank you.
Just a minute. Justice Bradley.
With regard to, and in your brief you say, you could argue, you could resolve this case either by traditional claim preclusion analysis or by making an exception for lot lines. Which do you think is the sounder way to go?
If this court, I thank you for asking me my opinion on that. That's quite an honor. I'll take a shot at it. If this court does a traditional analysis, the future arguments by those who Judge McMonagle thinks are creative like me or Mr. Wood, I'm going to say, well, that's those facts, but our facts are different. That's those facts. Our facts. They're going to make that limiting on that, and courts of appeals may have similar trouble, and trial courts may have similar trouble. I would suggest that the nature of a lot line is such that an effective exception could be written by this court so as to make it clear that at least once in the course of neighboring persons existing with that line between them somewhere, at least once, one or the other of them has a right to go to court and have somebody determine where that is exactly. That would take care of the claim preclusion problem. That would take care of the issue preclusion problem, because it would allow at least once for that line to be judicially determined. Thank you.
Sort of a sofa exception.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Gergen, and thank you, Mr. Wood, for your argument today about claim preclusion. This completes our oral arguments for today. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45, when we will have three more cases. We are in recess. The court will meet at 3:15.